Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a political analysis of the likely effect the Occupy Wall Street movement will have on the future of progressive politics in America and the elections next year. Michael Lynn joins us. He has an article at Salon.com, Occupation and Realignment, How a Real Leftist Movement Could Create a New Center in American Politics. And we will discuss the promise and pitfalls of a movement that now has a powerful and unifying economic message, which could be diffused by identity politics and other single-issue protests. Then we'll examine the Occupy Wall Street movement further with Michael Heaney, who is a professor of organizational studies and political science at the University of Michigan. We will discuss what political agenda and strategy will eventually emerge from this movement that is an apparent counterweight to the right-wing Tea Party, and how much it is a response to an acute sense of threat on the political left, which feels its political representatives have failed them. Then finally, Bill Maher joins us. He is the host of HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, and we will talk politics and humor in a political environment where political candidates, many of whom are running for president, provide such a rich serving of a comedic absurdity that it is difficult to tell whether life is imitating comedy or comedy imitating life. Joining us now is Michael Lind, a co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He is the author of Next American Nation, The New Nationalism, and The Fourth American Revolution. Among his other nonfiction books are The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. He has a new article in Salon, Occupation and Realignment, How a Real Leftist Movement Could Create a New Center in American Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Lind.
Thank you.
And you're, suggesting here, first of all, that will the worldwide Occupy demonstrations make 2011 the new 1968? And you follow that by saying, the liberal left must hope not. Explain.
Well, that's right. The worldwide leftist demonstrations of 1968 alienated the voting publics in much of Europe and North America and led to a generation of right-wing politicians, including Nixon and Reagan in the United States and Thatcher in Britain. And right now, you see the social democratic parties of Europe are in collapse. And arguably, that is because the radical left took a wrong turn. In my opinion, in the 1960s, it focused on kind of countercultural social issues rather than on the economic issues that had traditionally distinguished the left from the right. So let's hope that the Occupy movement, since it's focused very much on economic issues right now, retains that focus rather than getting into divisive cultural issues.
But my memory of the 60s and early 70s was that what's galvanizing the movement was the war in Vietnam. And the minute that Nixon ended that war, the movement dissipated. It had tremendous political strength.
That's true in the United States. I don't think that's so much true in France and Germany. Now, granted, they protested against the American war in Vietnam, but they were also rebelling against the older generation in their own countries. So, well, I think that's what you say is true in the U.S. case. There was kind of a global wave in 1968, late 60s, early 70s, and you're seeing a similar phenomenon today.
Well, in as much as the 60s demonstrations did not translate into political power, in fact, you're saying that Michael Lind, that they actually created a backlash, a kind of law and order backlash, and you can add to the list of Nixon and Reagan being elected. Look at the Supreme Court guys. These are guys that did not demonstrate in the 60s, and that line, at least in terms of the culture wars, is, lives on. But my understanding of the 99% movement is that they don't want to have anything to do with the Democratic Party, unlike the Tea Party that was captured by political pros like Karl Rove and Dick Armey and funded by the Kochs, and they got 60 to 70 people elected into Congress. Doesn't look like this movement wants anything to do with the Democratic Party.
Well, from reports, they remind me a great deal of the New Left, which had this ideal of participatory democracy as an alternative to hierarchical structures, including hierarchical party structures. As far as the Democratic Party is concerned, I think that both the center-left and the radical left, such that it is, should think of themselves as movements, not as partisans. You know, the Democratic Party has its progressive wing, but all political parties, and certainly these kind of incoherent parties we have in our two-party system in the United States, are coalitions of particular interests. And so, simply to equate the Democrats with progressivism, I think is a mistake. The Democrats are a coalition of certain regions of the country, certain industries like Hollywood and increasingly, sad to say, Wall Street, certain professions like trial lawyers. This kind of hodgepodge of special interests, however preferable it may be to the rival hodgepodge of special interests, is not the same thing as a movement, whether it's of the liberal left or the radical left.
Well, how much, though, do you think the notion of the 99%, which seems to be the branding, I mean, to my mind, that's pretty effective. And I believe that there is still some sense of fairness in this country and that there's a real sense that the disparity of wealth has gotten to an obscene level and our economy is more and more owned by the 1% and our politics is more and more controlled by the 1%.
My problem with it is I think that there are problems with the top 15 and 20% too, a group to which I and other college-educated professionals who are by no means rich belong. We've done very, very well in the last generation or so compared to the broad working class majority and this class of the working poor. I was about to say a caste because it's treated like an underclass. I have to tell you, I'm skeptical about the 99-to-1, because what that does is it says, just like in a way it's too much like the Democratic Party strategy, it says that if you make $250,000 a year or less, then you're part of the suffering masses. And if you make above $250,000 or above $1 million, you know, then you're part of this group that has profited from polarization. And in my opinion, you have to go much, much lower, you know, in order to include people making $100,000, $150,000, $250,000 a year, you know, are part of the elite. So I think what's going on here is you have the professional class has done fairly well, but it has not had these windfall profits that a small number of people in the financial community have had. And so since the Democrats have become increasingly a sort of hourglass coalition of upscale professionals and the very poor, having lost much of the white working class to the Republicans, the 99% idea, it sort of preserves this idea, this coalition of the affluent professional and the poor urbanite. But I just think, you know, sociologically, if you really want to attack privilege in this country, you can't simply stop with Goldman Sachs. You can start there. But you also have to look at, you know, overpaid doctors, overpaid lawyers, overpaid professors who teach a few classes a week while most classes are being taught by these underpaid lecturers. I think if you want a social justice movement, you have to look at the professions and not just at the bankers, though I agree that the bankers are the main cause of the problem, both with the economy and the polity today.
Well, what about the underpaid, though? I mean, what about the idea of raising boats as opposed to lowering them?
Well, you know, the most radical idea that you could put forth would be one that I would think would get a lot of traction in the country from all sides, which is a living wage. You turn the minimum wage into a living wage. And this is always objected to because it would cause mass unemployment. But if you have the government as employer of last resort, sopping up any employment that a higher wage does cause, and then you would bring it in gradually. Seems to me, you know, if I were to run for president, which I'm thinking about doing, by the way, since I'm reading that Newt Gingrich and Michelle Bachmann and Herman Cain, this is a way to sell books, evidently. It's a tough market for books out there, but evidently if you run for president, your campaign can buy vast numbers of copies. So,
well, there's nobody challenging Obama yet, so, you know, you've got an open field there, Michael.
For a campaign platform, every American who works 40 hours a week should not need to depend on government welfare. That's it, right? And this would be a truly radical idea. It would be popular. It would go against the trend of of Obama and Clinton-type liberalism, which is to allow employers to pay poverty wages, and then to use things like the earned income tax credit and various government subsidies and food stamps and so on to supplement it. But why not simply say, look, anyone who works 40 hours a week in this country is going to be paid enough to be independent, you know, to have a basic standard of decency. And that's not the way the left is going. You know, basically the way the liberal left is going is for more and more redistribution without addressing the cause of poverty level wages. Now granted, in a near depression, you know, the argument that higher wages will cause even more unemployment is a powerful one.
Right, but Michael, what about the other side of the formula here, which is the most used, which is taxation? And clearly, there's no tax fairness. Big corporations don't pay taxes, and neither do the wealthy. And the American people aren't like the Europeans, where they elect politicians who are stewards of their tax money. They elect people for all kinds of extraneous reasons and don't seem to expect anything back from the government. And guess what? They don't get very much back from the government.
Well, but here's the basic question that people need to ask themselves. Do we assume that this overpaid financial sector is going to be raking in all of this money 10 or 20 years from now and build a complex tax-based redistribution system around that? Or do we plan on there being fewer billionaires, even apart from taxation, simply because a lot of this is simply a bubble money? And it's been kept afloat. A lot of it is kind of fictitious money, and the government's bailed them out. But in the long run, a lot of that money is going to just vanish. They're going to take a haircut. And a lot of, now, they'll still be rich, but they'll be much less rich. Mm-hmm. It seems to me if we're thinking about the long-term tax system beyond this crisis, we do not want to make the mistake that California and New York did, which was to assume that the future, there would always be this concentration of wealth at the very top. And so therefore, not only would you simply tax the rich and then have all of these social programs and redistributive programs to transfer the wealth, however inadequately, but you would also actually do everything you can to encourage the financial sector, right? Certainly this is what New York City did, New York State.
Well, but I think you're talking about a bigger issue, Michael Lind, and that is the nature of modern American capitalism, that it's about extracting wealth and not creating wealth. That's a big debate, surely.
Well, that's exactly right. And from the New Deal period all the way up until the 1980s, 1990s, finance was seen to be the servant of production. And at this point, finance is just independent. Financial wealth is considered just as much wealth as productive wealth, so that the Chinese, you know, we'll gladly cede to them a lot of our factories, but as long as we can mint CDOs and mortgage-backed securities, then, you know, somehow that's the equivalent of the actual physical product, and of course it's not. In the long run, all financial assets are claims upon some kind of physical wealth somewhere, or on the labor of somebody. And unless the real productive economy is growing, at the end of the day, you know, you can have this illusion for a little while, but then, like the cartoon character, you know, you've gone off the cliff and you look down and then suddenly you drop when you realize where you are.
Well, Michael Lind, again, co-founder of the New American Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He has a new article at Salon, Occupation and Realignment, How a Real Leftist Movement Could Create a New Center in American Politics. Let's talk about your argument here, because I think it's, frankly, the first time I've seen a broader analysis of what might be happening here in these spontaneous movements that have sprung up with the Occupy Wall Street movement that have spread across the country and around the world. What you're saying here is that the Occupy Wall Street movement has the potential to help the center-left, even if some of its activists despise the center-left the way that the new left in the 1960s and 70s dismissed progressive liberals like Kennedy and Johnson as sinister corporate liberals promoting the welfare state. Walk us through that argument, if you will.
Well, my argument is that the concept of the political center is completely relative. It depends on the location of the goalposts on the left and the right. And what happened with the end of the Cold War was, as far as the economic left was concerned, the economic left used to be Marxism, various forms of Marxist socialism, and that pretty much fizzled out. And so at the same time, you had this libertarian far right, which is what it is, it wasn't a populist right, it was a sort of a radical free market right, was resurgent. And this free market right was well to the right of the old Rockefeller Republicans and even in many respects of the Reaganites and Nixonian conservatives. So what that meant was Reaganism and democratic policies that adapted to it, like those of Clinton and Obama, became the new center. So that Reagan and Thatcher became the new center. The new right was, you know, the extreme radical free market fundamentalism that was even to the right of Reagan and Thatcher. And then the radical left, as it were, the far left, became simply the old New Deal liberalism, which used to be centrist liberalism. But now it was considered the extreme. And so the point of my article is, if a point on the compass appears beyond what is now considered the far left, which is actually the center left, if you get a new radical left, then this shifts the entire landscape, which has shifted far to the right, and then it shifts the coordinates leftward, so that what has, you know, been the left, for example, Obama is always described as the left, right, in the media. You know, and in fact, he's, if anything, he's centrist or center-right. That would, if you had a real radical left, and I'm not saying the Occupy movement will turn into this, it may fizzle out or go a different direction, but a radical left that focuses primarily on economics rather than on other issues, at that point it creates a space in which you can have a center-left that can present itself as the mean between extremes, which is what, frankly, what successful politicians tend to do. You know, it benefits moderate conservatives immensely when they have the John Birch Society and the Ku Klux Klan out there, and it makes them look much more reasonable by comparison, right? And no. So it's I'm not advocating this. I'm just speculating.
But how does the radical left avoid identity politics and the balkanization, where, you know, people want to demonstrate on behalf of the Palestinians? They want to talk about gay and lesbian rights or immigration or you name it. I'm well aware of it here because we're sort of ground zero for identity politics here at Pacifica.
Well, that's a good question. You know, Marxism was wrong about, it was right about some things, but it was, you know, fundamentally wrong about its theory of history and the direction of the economy. But it had the benefit that there was a kind of theoretical structure there, at least among, you know, the more sophisticated schools of it, so that you could have a bouncer at the door and simply not admit various causes, which would obscure your message. You know, since the end of the Cold War, really since the 80s and 90s, you could go all the way back to the counterculture of the 60s, maybe. The radical left, such as it is a collection of all these single-issue groups. And the late Richard Rorty, he distinguished between movements and campaigns. It's a very useful distinction. Yeah. A movement is fundamentally about the structure of society, right? Progressivism, liberalism, socialism, libertarianism. Campaigns, whether it's, you know, to reduce greenhouse gases, you know, on behalf of gay and lesbian marriage, these may all be perfectly legitimate in their goals, but you can't simply string a bunch of campaigns together and put a rubber band around them and call it a movement, right?
Well, but you're saying, though, that the movement will only succeed if it focuses on the economy and...
To be a movement, it can't simply be a campaign, because if it's one campaign... Then you're quite right. You know, in the downtown park, 57 different other campaigns will show up with their own signs.
Well, and so far, though,
all these conflicting messages.
Right. But so far, the 99% message is strong. I think there's a growing recognition that we are less of a democracy and more of a corporate plutonomy, and there's just rampant evidence of corporate greed. And frankly, what looks like may happen in terms of galvanizing these issues in the presidential campaign of next year, it looks increasingly likely that Mitt Romney will be the candidate, and he's a perfect poster boy for corporatism with Bain Capital on Wall Street, and he's going to run as I'll be America's CEO. So do you think that this movement, even though it doesn't want anything to do with the Democrats at this point, could put the wind at Obama's back?
Yes, I think so, because if you look at the politicians we think of as being great reformers, whether it was Abraham Lincoln or Franklin Roosevelt, you know, being successful politicians, they were cautious, and they had to be forced sometimes by pressure from their left, the radical Republican abolitionists, in the case of Lincoln, in the trade unions and other groups, in the case of Roosevelt, in order to be more progressive than they would have been in the absence of this popular pressure, which sometimes, you know, took the form of the civil rights nonviolent demonstrations in the 50s and 60s, in the case of Kennedy and Johnson, and of the sit-down strikes in the middle of the 1930s, which sort of forced Roosevelt's hand and forced him to be more supportive of organized labor. So I think that that's the challenge. You know, if you can keep the focus on this theme of economic inequality and of the failure of Americans to share in the gains from growth, then I think this movement can serve a great purpose. If it fizzles out into little tiny micro movements with different agendas, then I think it will be as ineffectual as much of the left has been for the last 30 years.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Michael Lind.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Lind, a co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He's the author of Next American Nation, The New Nationalism, and The Fourth American Revolution. Among his other nonfiction books are The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. He has a new article at Salon, Occupation and Realignment, How a Real Leftist Movement Could Create a New Center in American Politics. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment.